So guys, welcome along to tonight's diabetes chat. This is, I believe, week 19 of the diabetes chat. And tonight is just going to be an incredible evening. It's our first ever research event on a diabetes chat. And we haven't just got one incredible guest speaker, not two, not three, not four, but five amazing guest speakers that are going to come on and share with the diabetes chat community a little bit about them and their research and their research studies, and just share with us all the amazing things that they're doing research wise, which is absolutely amazing. We just want to take this opportunity to obviously thank all our guest speakers for their time and coming on this evening. It's a privilege to have them here this evening, and especially as it's our first research event on a diabetes chat. I hope that everyone listening in enjoys the evening. I think it's going to be a fabulous evening, and should it go successful, which I'm sure it will, we can hopefully do more of these in the future. So each guest speaker will have 15 minutes to present and have a chat with us.
We have Louise Morales-Brown, Elpida Van Sulaki, Xiaozhong Sun, Dr. Xubing Chan, and Dr. Martin Dubok.
So absolutely amazing to have all our guest speakers here this evening. And I'm going to head over to Morgan, who's going to introduce Louise. And then, yeah, let's kick off.
Okay, so our first one for the night is going to be Louise Morales-Brown. She's currently a PhD student at Lancaster University in the UK. And she has an undergraduate degree in psychology and criminology. And she was diagnosed with type 1 in her mid-20s. And she went to go on to start her PhD journey after that. And her research is currently about exploring diabetes distress in adults and dealing with a recent diagnosis of type 1. So without further ado, I'm so excited.
Hi, Morgan. Thank you. To be fully transparent, I am a little nervous. Public speaking isn't something I'm really used to. But this seems like a really good opportunity to get out there and start practicing it. So I thought I'd just kind of start with adding a bit of background on myself, although Morgan did set me up fantastically. So in terms of work, I jump between social and user research within the public sector. But yes, I am in my spare time, I am a PhD student. So after I kind of completed my undergraduate, I went straight into work. For a few years, I was kind of out of academia, but it was my diagnosis of type 1 diabetes that kind of made me want to continue with it. So in 2017, at age 24, I went through A&E with kind of excessive urination and quenchable thirst, you know, a story I think a lot of us are familiar with, and then subsequently was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And it came as like a massive shock. No one in my family has diabetes. I didn't really know anything about it. And I just remember really struggling physically and mentally with the change. So following the diagnosis, I was actually signed off work for 2 months to kind of come to terms with it and get used to all the things that come with the condition, you know, like injecting insulin, checking glucose, you know the drill. So while I was off work, I did a lot of reading, particularly of academic papers. And to this day, I still don't really know why I chose to look at academic papers instead of a good book or some trash TV, but there you go. And what I was noticing was that adults recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes were often quite sought after for biological research, but not overtly included in psychological research. So yeah, where I'd been umming and ahhing about going back to academia before my diagnosis, it was noticing that kind of gap in the research where I just thought, you know what, I'm going to go fill it. So I looked for part-time PhD courses, found the one at Lancaster University, put forward a rough research idea, and I think it was around 6 months later that I began the course. So yeah, that's sort of my origin story, if we can call it that. So on to what I'm actually researching. So my research is looking at diabetes distress in adults recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, specifically in people who live in the UK and who've had the condition for at least a year and a max of 3 years. So those who might not be familiar with the term, so diabetes distress or diabetes related distress or diabetes specific distress are interchangeable terms which describe the adverse emotional experience of living with and managing diabetes. it's not considered a psychiatric disorder, but a rational emotional response to living with a chronic and demanding condition. And it can include, but isn't limited to feelings such as stress, worry, feeling overwhelmed and frustration. So to give a bit more kind of information on sources of diabetes distress, a good way to explain it is taking a look at the broad categories from the surveys we use to measure it. So two of the most common ways to measure diabetes distress is the diabetes distress scale and the type 1 diabetes distress scale. So the diabetes distress scale was designed with and for those with type 2 diabetes, and it classifies sources of diabetes distress into four broad themes. That's regimen-related distress, emotional burden, physician distress, and interpersonal distress. And then you have the type 1 diabetes distress scale, which is developed with and for those with type 1 diabetes, and actually contains more sources of diabetes distress. This one has 7 themes, and those are powerlessness, management distress, hypoglycemic distress, negative social perceptions, eating distress, physician distress, and friend/family distress. So in the first instance, this highlights that although there are some similarities in sources and experiences of diabetes distress in those with type 1 and type 2, there are also a number of differences. In fact, what research has actually demonstrated is that concerns within each of the themes, as well as how diabetes distress is conceptualized and experienced, are more nuanced and complex than just that duality of type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So to give some examples, research looking at diabetes distress in older adults with type 2 diabetes found that their experience of diabetes distress was heightened due to forgetfulness due to the risks it posed in missing dosages of medication. And then another study looking at those living with type 2 diabetes but on insulin treatment instead of tablets found that they experienced distress related to hypoglycemia in a similar way to those with type 1 diabetes. However, in the scales I just mentioned, the one for those with type 2 diabetes doesn't include a category for distress related to hypoglycemia. And one last example, there was a study in Canada which explored diabetes distress within the Chinese Canadian community, and they found aspects of distress that weren't included in the surveys, one being that the clinicians would often recommend dietary patterns to follow which were more reflective of an American or Western diet, and omitted and did not consider Chinese culture and eating habits. So what this kind of tells us is that it's really important to examine how diabetes distress looks like for different groups, as this helps to understand their sources of distress and the context in which it arises. Also, where higher levels of diabetes distress are associated with poorer self-management and HbA1c levels. So it's important we gather the knowledge on sources and experience of diabetes distress to make sure people receive the right type of support and interventions in order to minimize this stress. And although I did mention its effect on HbA1c levels, I think regardless of that, because let's be honest, everything seems to link back to HbA1c levels when we talk about diabetes, but regardless as to whether or not diabetes distress impacts HbA1c levels, what is important is to continually take steps to improve psychological and emotional welfare in people with diabetes. Now, as I alluded to earlier, adults recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes haven't really been examined in the remit of diabetes distress. And this group likely have a unique experience, as those diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in children, by the time they reach adulthood, have often spent a really large portion of their life dealing with the condition, and often, but not always, with little memory of life pre-diagnosis, because living with diabetes has just kind of become the status quo. Whereas those diagnosed as adults have gone kind of many years of their lives without the condition and have to navigate integrating that with their established way of life. As such, the experience of diabetes distress for this group may entwine with a new way of life and identity that often accompanies the diagnosis of a chronic condition. So, as well as looking at the experience of diabetes distress among a group of individuals that haven't really been explored yet, I think what's also really interesting is the context in which the research is taking place. So firstly, the research is based in the UK, where the structure of healthcare is different to, say, for example, the USA, where quite a lot of diabetes distress research has been conducted, as they adhere to an insurance-based healthcare system, where we have in the UK have the National Health System, the NHS. And also, when I originally wrote the proposal, the pandemic wasn't on my radar, so COVID-19 didn't exist at that point. So what will be quite interesting to explore is, so for example, the experience I had of being diagnosed with diabetes a few years ago is going to be very different to someone who went through that, through their diagnosis and their first few years of living with diabetes during a pandemic with the lockdowns and the restrictions and the kind of changes that had on healthcare practices. In terms of what I've done so far with the research, so I've done 6 interviews so far. I haven't finished data collection yet, so at this stage I don't have any juicy findings to share with you, but as part of my PhD I also had to conduct a systematic literature review, which I've now completed and I'm refining, so I can talk a bit about those findings. So for those who might not know, a systematic literature review is a type of review that collects multiple research studies about a topic and summarises them to answer a research question in a critical and methodical way. So the systematic review that I've been working on was attempting to answer the question, what underpins experiences of diabetes distress? So I wanted to go below the surface a bit and look beyond just sources and feelings associated with diabetes distress, to better understand what constructs are kind of underneath it and start thinking about why some people might be more prone to feel distress while others might not. And what my review seemed to find was that underlying diabetes distress were broadly issues associated with autonomy and identity. So for example, regarding identity, the narratives of participants included in the review, they reported negative self-perceptions that were often tied to diabetes, and where they tended to view diabetes negatively, by association, the participants experiencing diabetes distress viewed themselves in a similar light. And the condition seemed to almost latch onto participants' personalities and the way they define themselves. The second area that I mentioned underlying diabetes distress that I found in this review was autonomy. So autonomy refers to self-government and feeling in responsible control of one's life. And what I found in this review was, in the people experiencing diabetes distress, was that diabetes was being interpreted as an inescapable and dominating feature which instilled powerlessness, and concerns around the demands of a condition often took precedent over personal desires, and this led to participants feeling controlled by the condition. And this sentiment was also apparent when glucose levels became difficult to control or viewed as unpredictable. There are also issues around autonomy in how people, how the participants would perceive at times healthcare professionals or family members as being overbearing or trying to get too involved with their diabetes care, which led to feelings of frustration. However, it's also important to note that on the flip side of that, too little support was reinforcing feelings of isolation. So in future, it might be helpful to test the findings from the review by taking constructs that are tied with autonomy and identity and seeing how they're associated with diabetes distress. So if I give an example, so there is a concept called locus of control. And if you have a strong external locus of control, you believe that outcomes in life are the result of external factors such as circumstance, fate, or unfairness. And if you have a strong internal locus of control, you tend to believe the outcomes of your life are a result of your own actions. So it might be very interesting for research to start to explore how locus of control may be associated with diabetes distress. And kind of getting a clearer picture of these linked elements, once again, might be helpful to how we support or provide intervention for those struggling with diabetes distress. And yeah, I thought I'll just kind of end with like, what's the next step? So I'm still looking for 2 more people to take part in my research. So I'm just going to do a shameless plug time. So if anyone listening wants to take part or knows someone who might be suited to take part, please have a look at the link to my research study on my page. I think it might also be distributed in the hashtag. So yeah, please take a look at that. And then kind of after that, I need to dedicate a few months to analysis, kind of sitting with the data, drawing findings and conclusions from it. for this particular bit of work, I'm doing a form of analysis which is called interpretive phenomenological analysis, which is still a mouthful for me to say after having to say it for many months. And this approach to data analysis just seeks insights into how a person in a given context makes sense of a given phenomenon, in this case, diabetes distress. And kind of after all that, once I've written it up and submitted it, it'll be my viva. And hopefully if I pass my viva, I can sleep and go on holiday because it's been a really long few years. But yeah, that's kind of my research in a nutshell.
Thank you so much, Louise. That was absolutely immense. And what a way to kick off our research event this evening. Honestly, thank you so much. And you just spoke with so much energy and you were amazing. So thank you so much.
Louise, I have a quick question for you, actually. I was just quite interested. I was diagnosed a long time ago, so I'm not particularly suitable for your survey. But you were talking about a sort of internal and external factors and stuff like that. What if you kind of believe a bit of both? Like, if there's an earthquake, I can't control that, but I can control how fast I run out of the city, for example. I'm kind of in between on that. Like, how would that work?
So I think that's a really interesting question. So I'm not an expert on locus of control, as that is kind of that's a separate concept to autonomy. But I think from my understanding of it, it's more kind of like outcomes. Such, for example, if the example they typically do is if you didn't do well on a test, is the example there. So for example, some people might say, well, you know what, I gave it my best shot, I tried everything I could, and that's it. Where other people might say, you know what, that's just unfair, that was a hard test, that's out of my like control completely. So does that make a bit more sense? I don't know how. I think you raise a very good point with the earthquake example, but I don't think I know enough about locus of control to be able to expand on the bits of both.
No, that does make a bit more sense. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Louise.
Next up, we have Elpida Barantzoulaki. Elpida is a epidemiologist at Leicester Real World Evidence Unit, Diabetes Research Centre in the University of Leicester in the UK. She has a solid background in clinical practice and research, having graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in Nursing and a Master's in Medical Research. Her primary interests include the prevention and management of diabetes and other cardiometabolic complications, real-world epidemiology, and medical statistics.
Hello, thank you so much for the introduction. Can you hear me properly?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you for the introduction. Thank you so much for having us today. I'm really excited about this event because, well, as researchers, we have the opportunity to take part in conferences all the time. I think we don't really have the opportunity to speak to the patients and public as much. And I think that's also something that we should do more often. So what I'm aiming to do today is like speak less and leave more room for questions. So I will try to summarize things as quick as possible so we'll have more time for questions and a discussion because I'm really excited about this. Just a bit about my background. As you said, I currently work as an epidemiologist at the Diabetes Center and just finishing my PhD. My PhD focuses on the relationship between gestational diabetes and type 2. For those of you who are not familiar with gestational diabetes mostly, it is a condition that causes high blood glucose levels, and it first appears during pregnancy and usually disappears after a woman gives birth. And how gestational diabetes is related to type 2 diabetes is that women who had a diagnosis of gestational diabetes during pregnancy, although the condition disappears after they give birth, they have a higher risk of getting a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in the future. So during my PhD, I did a study where we found that the risk of getting a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes is even higher than previously observed in these women. And women who had a diagnosis of gestational diabetes in pregnancy are now 10 times more likely to get a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. And also type 2 diabetes prevalence is on the rise. So all these things consider there's definitely something that needs to be done about this. I first started working with women with gestational diabetes during my master's, and I got interested in the relationship between gestational and type 2 diabetes. So after I did this study in my PhD, where we found the tenfold higher risk of type 2 diabetes, I thought it was really interesting to see what happens and what we can do to prevent type 2 diabetes. So the current guidelines from NICE recommend that women who had gestational diabetes in pregnancy should take a test after they give birth and be tested to see how the glucose levels are after they give birth and gestational diabetes goes away. But what research has shown so far is that screening is not being done consistently, and there's a problem in getting more women to get screened. So the aim of this research was to see the rates, investigate the rates of screening attendance for type 2 diabetes in women who had gestational diabetes, and see how many women get tested, and if there are certain patient characteristics, such as the age of the patients or the ethnicity of the patients, that are associated with more regular screening for type 2 diabetes. So what this study found was that while most women attend screening for type 2 diabetes at least once in the first 5 years after they give birth, where the risk is quite higher of getting a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, less than 25% of them get a test once a year, as the guidelines recommend. So there seems to be inconsistencies between what the guidelines recommend and what is happening in clinical practice. And also, in terms of patient characteristics, women who are South Asian were more likely to get a test for type 2 diabetes after giving birth from a pregnancy complicated by gestational diabetes. And also women who were older, women who received either metformin or insulin during pregnancy to treat gestational diabetes, and also women who had the diagnosis of polycystic ovary syndrome, they were also more likely to get a test for type 2 diabetes after giving birth. So all in all, it appears that there is a gap between the guidelines and what happens in clinical practice. And this is because of two reasons. So one reason could be that clinicians are not aware that they should be screening these women, because there's currently confusion in clinical practice of whether women who have gestational diabetes should be managed in primary or secondary care after they give birth. So one reason could be that. And also there's another reason is that women themselves don't know that they should get tested, because they see gestational diabetes as something temporary. So they are not aware of the increased risk of a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in the future. Or even they are aware of the risk, but the responsibilities associated with having a new child is something that interferes with getting screened. So there's a need for more research to look into all that and see how we can approach women, what strategies can be developed, and how these strategies can be tailored to the needs of every individual, because every individual is different and needs to be approached in a different way. So we can get more women to attend screening, get screening rates higher, because that's really important in prevention of type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is largely preventable, so it is feasible to intervene early on and reduce progression to type 2 diabetes, or even manage it if diagnosed early on. So that's all from me today. I'm happy to receive any questions or discuss anything relevant to the research. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'd just like to point out, you were talking about how some women weren't like going for regular tests after. I can confirm that. My little sister had gestational diabetes. She's also quite a fan of Lucozade, but that's an entirely different story. But she hasn't been advised to go for yearly tests at all, like by anyone. She recovered afterwards. They did a test after she'd given birth and stuff, and that was it.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me know about what is happening in clinical practice as well, because that's something I don't have a lot of experience on at the moment, because I work in research due to my PhD mainly. So it's nice to know what is happening with patients in clinical practice. So it is true, and there's research in the UK, there's been some studies where they interview GPs, and they ask them whether they have invited women or whether they knew, and it's usually less likely. So there is actually a problem with that, and it's really important to structured programs of education, especially within primary care, because primary care is where these women are mainly managed. So it would be good to get education for clinicians, so more clinicians know about the risk, more women are invited, so more women get screened, and potentially more type 2 diabetes cases are prevented. So that's something very interesting to know. Thank you.
I think we've lost Morgan.
I had a question real quick. Is there any research looking into the risks of developing not just type 2, but other types of diabetes as well, postpartum?
So there have been some studies so far. It's mainly type 2 diabetes that is prevalent in this population, but there are also some studies of type 1 after gestational diabetes, although that's not most cases. But it is being investigated because it's quite complicated as well, and more rare types of diabetes have not been investigated as much. So I think we'll be learning more about it in the future. And there's also really interesting research on the genetic aspects. So looking at the genes of women with gestational diabetes and comparing them to genes of women, for example, who have mature diabetes, mature onset diabetes of the young, and there seems to be like all sorts of like similar things to observe. So it's quite interesting that research is now looking at all these things and is trying to explain what happens in an individual with gestational diabetes, for example.
Do you think this ties in just with the overall sort of progressive nature of type 2? I mean, you mentioned the PCOS, which makes sense because we already know that that's sort of associated with risk for type 2. But do you think that maybe it's just the stress of the being pregnant that winds up sort of starting the ball rolling down the hill, and once it gets enough speed that it eventually merits the full type 2 diagnosis?
So in terms of polycystic ovary syndrome and all these characteristics that I mentioned, these were associated with a greater likelihood of getting a test for type 2. But then again, these, as you said, they're the characteristics of someone who's more likely to get a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. So it seems like general practitioners are recommending screening to those who are most at risk, which could make sense in many ways. In terms of what causes this, gestational diabetes and type 2 have similar risk factors. So obesity is a shared risk factor. Coming from certain ethnic groups is a risk factor as well. Older age is a risk factor. So they have similar risk factors. So they have, research has described gestational diabetes as an early warning sign of type 2 diabetes. So it is kind of a bell ringing saying, you know, this patient has a like high risk of type 2 diabetes, so they should be closely monitored. And that is why screening is important, and like changing our perceptions around gestational diabetes and seeing it as more of a long-term condition rather than a temporary state of health is important.
Thank you so much for coming on this evening and sharing your amazing research. It's so fascinating, and it's just lovely to have that perspective So thank you so much, Alpida.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next up, we have Chaozhong Sun, who is a third year PhD student at King's College in London. She is currently using interdisciplinary approaches to investigate effective communication strategies that may be beneficial for people's diabetes-related knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors, especially with the potential role that social media influences play in people's diabetes management and health promotion. Without further ado, we welcome our next guest speaker, Chaozhong Sun. Hello.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you so much for coming on this evening.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Yeah. You really have talent in pronouncing Chinese Mandarin. Yeah, good evening, everyone. And I'm so happy to virtually meet all of you guys today. Actually, I've been excited for 2 days after I received the confirmation message from Tom. And I'm so happy to be here to share my research with you. And please feel free to ask any questions after my presentation. And I'm always happy to receive any feedback from you. So let me start by saying just a few words about myself. I'm Chaozhong Sun, a third year PhD student at King's College London, and Tom has described. Actually, I have more than 5 years of research experience in media and communications, and 2 years of working experience at the national medium in media in China. So the reason why I'd like to do the research in health communication is that after doing those kind of work, I really believe that media and communication has the potential to change our understanding of the world as well as maybe our way of working or living. And so that reinforced my passion or interest in investigating the effective communication strategies that might be beneficial for people's health-related outcomes. And the reason why I'd like to focus on diabetes, because personally I don't have diabetes, but my grandma has type 2 diabetes for several years, and one of my best friends are living with type 1 for more than 10 years. And I do think that not only maybe healthcare professionals or team members have the responsibility to do things for people with diabetes, but also maybe for researchers, we can also play a role in providing our thoughts or ideas, use the research statistic or the different interdisciplinary methodology to do things for people living living with diabetes. So I want to be that kind of researcher, so I did this. My project is health communication and the diabetes narratives of K social media influencers in the UK. And today I only want to give you an overview of my research aims and the research method I use, as well as the future step that maybe I need your support in the following following month. Before I introduce the research aims, I would like to introduce three keywords in my study, which are health communication narratives and social media influencers. Well, in the research field, health communication is the kind of study or the way of use communication strategies to inform or influence individuals' decision that could enhance people's health. But the most essential objectives of health communication, no matter in social science or in media studies, is to persuade audience to change beliefs or behaviors towards certain health issues. Well, which means that if the communicator provides information in the right way or they use the right communication strategies, people not only with diabetes or also with other health problems are more likely to successfully changing behaviors or attitudes and even improve the level of knowledge. However, we know that all these outcomes depend heavily on whether the effective or successful health communication occurred. And there do have some obstacles will influence the effectiveness of health communication, such as we may don't satisfied with the information we received, or we don't trust the information to help us make the decision. Therefore, we may not want to make any changes. So it's important to investigate the ways to maintain or improve the effectiveness of health communication. Given this, the second word, narrative, comes here. Narrative, in the research perspective, it can be seen as the effective communication strategy because of this persuasive effect in influencing individuals' beliefs and even their behaviors. And the reason why narrative works and how it works, there are so many reasons, but I only want to explain maybe one most important one, because that narrative has the potential to invite readers or patient or audience into story actions and immerse them in the real or plausible life experience of others. Therefore, maybe people feel difficult to disagree with their ideas, and this can enhance audience acceptance of the value or the beliefs portrayed in the story. Take it more simple. Maybe if the story is well told, listeners are more likely to experience emotions that can maybe soften their position or enable them to consider the speaker's point of view. Although the narrative have this potential, but we can't ignore the influence of the power of the new technology bring to us and in the field of health communication, such as social media, because it changes the way we communicate, not only health, but also making our online communicating culture more collaborative, participatory, or things like that. However, information on social media has different quality, I think, and due to its informal and unregulated mechanism in information collection, sharing, or promotion, and it's hard for us to trust the information that we saw on social media. So the issue might be solved by if the health related information can be obtained from sources that we rely on, or it's a credible or reliable sources on social media. So the last word I would like to express here is social media influencers. They are individuals who are highly respected, connected, or informed, visible on social media. They may have established a closely relation with their followers, audience, or friends, earned trust and credibility in the specific area. And in my research, those diabetes-related social media influencers refers to all those accounts, no matter it's individual or organizational. They could be diabetes academic professionals, healthcare professors, celebrities, or individuals who are living with diabetes like some of you, or the online group or communities like a diabetes chat. However, the previous research, as I do the literature review, all focus on the value of social media influencers in marketing and advertising field, focusing on emphasizing the use of social media influencers to promote or endorse products or services in business. So there's no published research till now examining the effect of diabetes narratives on audience in the field of health communication and the potential role that diabetes-related social media influencers playing in diabetes management. Therefore, I started thinking about doing this study and linking work on influencers in marketing to health communication, exploring the potential of social media influencers in health communication intervention, and some benefits and challenges, especially when COVID-19 happened, will hopefully be reviewed in the future after I finish all the data collection and the final thesis. Therefore, The primary of this study is to investigate the diabetes narrative presented by key social media influencers in the UK and the potential impact they may have on audience health related outcomes. And the question for my research is to I formulated as four. The first one is, who are the most significant health-related social media influencers in the UK? And of these, who focuses on diabetes? The second one is, what diabetes narratives do they present? And what kind of professional knowledge or their personal experience do they communicate through social media platforms? The third one is, how do influencers determine what messages to deliver and what factors influence their decision-making process? And the last one mainly focuses on the audience and people living with diabetes, is what are the potential implications of their diabetes-related narratives on audience health-related knowledge, attitude, and behaviors? That's all the whole background and the research questions of my research. I only want to spend maybe 2 minutes to introduce the method I used in the research. As this interdisciplinary research, so I used a mixed method combining both quantitative and qualitative approaches. And I used social networking analysis to identify key social media influencers, including individuals and organizational accounts, and then use semi-structured interview to know more about the influencers' perspective on their process of communicating diabetes. And then I decided to use online questionnaire to know more about the audience perspective. And narrative analysis will be used to examine the influencers' social media content. If the method used, so the four research questions could be answered. And in this research, Twitter has been chosen as the social media platform to extract data and identify influencers, and also for the participant recruitment. And there are three types of participants in my study. First one, the social media users who are living with diabetes, and the second part of the group is the individual social media influencers who create and share diabetes related information, and the last part of the participant is professionals who works at diabetes related or health related organizations in the UK and in charge of social media account. Till now, I finished all the identified the influencers, finished extracted the social media data on Twitter using Twitter API, and I have interviewed 12 influencers such as Pathika Amanda or the Dr. Emma also in this group. And I finished the interview 12 professionals, such as the program director at NHS Diabetes Program or the head of digital at Diabetes UK. There are only 2 minutes. I want to conclude by inviting you, someone who is interested in my research, to participate in the questionnaire or participating in the interview for influencers and professionals. I would like to invite people who live with diabetes aged 80 years old and above, and who have more than 1 year's registration on any social media platform to take part in my survey. And 1 minute, okay, before I stop, let me just say thank you for everyone to be here today listening to me sharing my research, and I will be much appreciated if you could join my research or retweet my research. And if you have any questions, we can just communicate afterwards, because I don't want to waste the next speaker's time. I didn't use the time for questions. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chao Jong-sun. That was incredible. And it was just so fascinating to listen to. And it's amazing for all the work that you're doing. So now we're going to go to our next guest speaker, Dr. Xubing Chan. Dr. Xubing Chan received her BS and MS in chemistry and her PhD at BRICS Research Institute. After graduation, she joined the Dr. Douglas Melton Laboratory at Harvard University and is currently the Kilt Family Professor and Director of Diabetes Program at the Department of Surgery and Department of Biochemistry at Wales Cornell Medical College. Wow, that just sounds incredible. What a title that is. So welcome this evening, Dr. Xubing Chan.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for the organizer. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. It's really my great honor. I have been studying diabetes for many, many years, but I also use Twitter, but this is actually the first time that I joined a Twitter chat, and it's a very interesting experience, and I would love to hear your feedback and also your comments. So first, I want to thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity, and also I really appreciate the very generous introduction. So I was trained as a chemist and then studying diabetes. So in my lab, we are very interested in how to use stem cell-derived cells as a model to study different diseases, including diabetes. And we have been studying diabetes for more than 15 years, I would say. And originally, we were very interested in like how different genetic factors, how different environmental factors contribute to the diabetes progression. And then we want to know, then this can help us to build the foundation to identify drugs. We call it precision medicine, or another way to understand is for personalized medicine. It's one way to understand is that people get diabetes because of different reasons. And if we know the reason, we can develop more precise treatment for each patient. So that's basically more like a large picture of our research. And at the 2020, when New York City became, very unfortunately, became the pandemic center, and we immediately decided to use our stem cell-derived cells to study COVID. And we have, actually, we have a very large platform. We can make multiple type of cells, like lung cells, like gut, we call it organoid. They have a three-dimensional structure. They have like small intestine, large intestine. We can make pancreatic cells. We can make liver. It's all human. And we can make like blood cells. We can make like heart cells. And so the first question we want to, because we have this platform, in a way you can think about, we can have different human cells or tissues. And then the first question we want to ask is, which type of cells, which tissue organ or which type of cells can be infected by SARS-CoV-2, which is a virus that's caused COVID pandemic. And kind of as expected, we find like lung tissue can be infected because many COVID patients, we know it's a major lung disease. And small intestine, large intestine or tissue can be infected because we know a lot of COVID patients, they develop GI symptoms. And it's a little bit surprising, we find the heart cells can also be infected. And indeed, a lot of COVID patients, they also have heart problem, they have arrhythmia. And very, very surprisingly, we find that pancreatic beta cells, which is a cell type that make insulin. And insulin is a major hormone that maintain blood glucose level. I'm sure if you are interested in diabetes, you must heard a lot. And we find that pancreatic beta cell can also be infected. This is completely unexpected results. And when we see that, and because I study diabetes, actually, I also work as a director of diabetes program at Weill Cornell. So I also talk with a lot of clinical doctors in the ICU, and they told us that they find it's very, very difficult to control the blood glucose level for the COVID patients. Well, usually, you know, that's their job. That's endocrine, that's endocrinologist's job. So they're very good to control patient blood glucose level, but they said they find it's very challenging or very difficult. So then we realized that maybe our basic science research indeed has some clinical implication. So then we start to deep further to say, oh, if beta cell can be infected, what happened to this beta cell? So we run some like state-of-the-art technology we call single cell RNA-seq so that we can track the transcriptome change, like RNA change at each individual cells before and after SARS-CoV-2 infection. And we find that first we check the insulin, which is a major hormone that beta cell make that lower the blood glucose level. We find that after SARS-CoV-2 infection, the insulin level significantly decreased. And then, so that basically after SARS-CoV-2 infection, the beta cell can make less insulin. And then we next we check some other hormones, for example, like glucagon in alpha cells or like trypsin in Eisner cells. And then we realize that all these non-beta cell markers are significant increase. So that we call it transdifferentiation. That means after SARS-CoV-2 infection, the beta cell basically changed their identity. They are not active beta cell anymore. So they kind of make less insulin and start to doing other jobs. So that is basically the first finding we had. I think that can basically help a little bit to understand why COVID patient has very severe diabetes phenotype. And in the meanwhile, we are working on, so then we basically try to understand why this beta cell will become transdifferentiated. So we we go back to check their RNA change at a single cell level, and we find the cell face a lot of cell stress associated pathway got significant increase, such as EAF pathway. And then we basically check the we basically monitor the cell stress, and we find that after SARS-CoV-2 infection, the cell beta cell stress significant increase. And we also confirm these results in the patient samples. They basically take some autopsy samples from the COVID patients, basically the pancreatic sample from the patient who passed away because of COVID. And then we check their pancreas. And indeed, we see the beta cell, they lose the insulin expression, and they begin the markers for other type of cells. And lastly, now we are kind of doing some study to understand how immune system contribute to the disease progression. And for a separate story, we find that the immune cells such as macrophage are significantly accumulated in the heart of the COVID patients. And then we even run the drug screening, and we find some small molecules that can block immune cell induced heart damage. And currently and one of the drug is a JAK inhibitor, and coincidentally, when we publish our story, FDA also approved the JAK inhibitor for the emergency use of COVID patients, so which we are very proud of that. Yeah, so and as a basic scientist, we use Twitter a lot to promote the papers, and so we hope that in the future, we can also use Twitter more to enhance the communication and scientific discussion, and thank Diabetes Chat for leading the effort on that. Yeah, I think that's pretty much what I want to talk about, and happy to answer any questions you have.
Have you identified any of the specific receptor targets? Is it all the ACE2 receptors on the cells that the SARS-CoV-2 virus is using to infect them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's a big controversy in the beta cell field whether ACE2 is expressed. And based on the single cell RNA-seq data, the ACE2 expression is very, very low. But the immunostaining, depending on the antibody, you get different results. But what we find that single cell RNA-seq might not be a very sensitive way to monitor the ACE2 expression. And when we do the immunostaining, we find another factor of SARS-CoV-2, which called neurofilin 1, is highly expressed in beta cell, which colocalizes with beta cell. So what we're thinking, and in a paper which published together with ours on the same issue of cell metabolism, they use neurofilin one antibody which can block SARS-CoV-2 infection. So suggesting that in at least in beta cells, so the SARS-CoV-2 infection is not completely dependent on the ACE2, and neurofilin one may also play a very important role in SARS-CoV-2 infection in beta cells.
Thank you so much, Dr. Xubin Chan, for coming on and speaking today on a diabetes chat.
Thank you for the invitation. Yeah.
You're very welcome. Guys, if you want to join in the discussion this evening, then you can hashtag diabetes chat and you can send any questions or comments to this evening's amazing guest speakers.
It's been absolutely awesome. I've actually been quite interested in some of the research they've come on with as well.
Absolutely. And if you haven't already, check them out further, isn't it? And maybe go participate in some of these amazing clinical trials and research project studies. But yeah, guys, go check it out. It's absolutely quality stuff.
But please don't die so that they can check your cells for SARS-CoV-2 infection. We don't need anybody participating that way.
Yeah, currently there are several clinical studies ongoing, and if you want, you can just send me a note by Twitter. I can send you the information. So because early days, that was in last 2 years, there was some study to show the individual case if the patient got COVID, they also got diabetes. And I also, because our research on COVID and diabetes, we unfortunately also received some email that some mom sent me an email say their kids just a teenager age and got COVID, and like 1 month later they got type 1 diabetes or diabetes. So but early this year CDC the Center of Disease Control they publish a large population study, and they indeed show that there is an increased risk for diabetes in the COVID patient, particularly they are younger than 30 years old. So, and currently NIH, National Institute of Health in United States, is funding several clinical studies that try to understand the relationship between COVID and diabetes. Hopefully this is helpful.
And our last guest speaker tonight is Dr. Martin De Bock. He qualified from the University of Auckland School of Medicine in 2003 and has completed subspecialist training in pediatric endocrinology, which included clinical service and a PhD. He is a pediatric consultant in Christchurch, New Zealand, and a leading researcher in diabetes technologies, especially automated insulin delivery systems. So welcome to Dr. Martin De Bock.
Yeah, morning. It's evening for you, but it's early morning here, 8:30 in the morning in New Zealand.
Thank you for coming on such an early time.
That's no problem. I had to come to work anyway, unfortunately. It's one of those things, isn't it?
Indeed.
Look, effectively, as you know, in the open source area for automated insulin delivery, which well and truly predated commercial systems, people with diabetes developed an algorithm that was highly effective. And there were lots of real-world data that were coming out in lay media, in the literature, and very small studies. But it was always criticized for being in highly motivated, tech-savvy individuals with type 1 diabetes, because it was felt by the general community that it was a bit tricky to get it going, you know, getting, setting up with Riley Links at that time with old pumps and trying to build the system from scratch. And the feeling was that it wouldn't be generalizable. However, the data that was coming out was pretty undeniable that it was very good in terms of people's outcomes, and both in terms of their glucose levels, but also their quality of life. So it was high time that a study with the highest scientific integrity was designed to really put to bed the whole safety and efficacy around open source automation. And that was really for two reasons, lots of reasons really, but the main reasons for me were to, I guess, justify the amount of work that had been done by the community with type 1 diabetes to develop the system to where it was, and also I guess to quieten down some of the negative comments that were coming out around open source, and that, you know, this is sort of on the fringes or shouldn't be endorsed. And there's a lot of sort of worry when you're in clinic on the clinician side, which I am, about the sort of the ethical and regulatory issues with that, because it is a non-regulated system, I guess. That's not so bad in some places in the world, but I think in the US that's more of a challenge. So what we undertook is a large-scale randomized controlled trial, which is sort of the best method to do to check for efficacy. And we did it for long enough to go safety, so that was 6 months. And we did a wide age range, so 7 years to 70 years old. The open source was an Android APS algorithm. Well, Dana will probably can always pitch in there. She's on, I see, to give the technicalities of the exact platform we use. We put some guardrails on it just for safety, but not a lot. Basically, they had a four-week run-in where they just got used to the hardware. So it was a new pump and new infusion sets. And lots of our people that were on the study were real-time CGM naive. So it was a little bit trying to get their heads around that, which was a bit undertaking. And then they were randomized to either go to open source or to stay on sensor-augmented pump therapy for 6 months. The primary outcome was really to see what the time and range was at the end between those two groups. Then we had a bunch of secondary outcomes, which are your standard CGM metrics like time low, time very high, the average glucose, that kind of thing. And also, the most important thing for us was that safety factor. And that was really checking for severe hypoglycemia and episodes of diabetic ketoacidosis. So the study was powered for a small change, which we didn't actually, we overpowered, I guess, because we had 100 people into the study. So it's a big study. Three dropped out in the run-in. They just didn't like the setup. And then after randomization, we only had two withdraw from the intervention arm. For those who are on who don't know what really that means, it just means that that when you set up a study, you try and figure out how many people would drop out, because you always get people that drop out. And if people find it hard or tricky or don't like it, you'll get quite a high attrition rate. And typically, you factor in for about a 10% dropout. The fact that we only got two drop out really tells you that the system was really well tolerated. People liked it and didn't want to come off the study because of the treatment burden. So that's a really nice sort of soft way of looking at how people enjoyed the system. So the time, just a little bit about our character, the participants in the study. We kind of paired it into two groups. We stratified by age. So we had a pediatric cohort who was 7 to 16 and an older group who was 16 and up. The baseline time and range was about 55% for the children and slightly higher in the adults, about 60%. And the A1C was a bit contrary, because we had an A1C that was 7.5% in the children, but it was higher despite the better time and range in the adults, about 7.6%. So they're close to target, I guess, HbA1c. There's a lot of push now to get a wider spread of A1c. In our inclusion criteria, we allowed up to 10.5%. And in retrospect, we should have just opened that right up and just had it all comers. And that's where everybody's moving to now to make it really generalizable. I'll come back to reason why we should do that, perhaps in the Q&A or if I get time to some of the reason up about why we should be more open in terms of who we put on the studies. But at the point, we were just a little bit, I guess, cautious with the whole setup. You know, we're clinicians in the end. We always want to make sure that we're doing it well. And, you know, some people would have thought that we were quite brave in the first place. So the primary outcome, time and range. So we got a 14% time and range difference. So that's quite a lot. That was really overall the time and range for both the children and adults was about 72% using automation. So remember that 70% is the benchmark. So we try and get above 70%. And so 72% is really good. It's as good as the commercial systems that have been reported in the literature and similar sort of studies. So that was really nice to show. That was really made up by a big shift up in time and range in the adults and children, but particularly at night. All automated systems are awesome at night, as I'm sure people on here or who are users will know that and attest to it. The adults actually improved their time and range at night by 30%, so it was pretty unbelievable. That's a huge amount of difference. And to me, the cool thing was about how many people reached that gold standard of 70% time and range or more. So only 15% in the control arm using achieved that, but 60% achieved that in the intervention. So that's a four times more people reached time and range target of greater than 70%. So that's a huge, huge factor. What else did we see? So there was no increase in hypoglycemia, which is always where you leverage, because you worry that if you get more time and range, you push people's glucose levels lower, that you might push them into hypo, but we didn't see that at all, which is awesome. And then the A1C dropped by 0.5%, 0.6% in adults, 0.5% overall. So that's it's also a pretty significant improvement. It's clinically meaningful as well as just a number. And then moving on to safety, the two main things were severe DKA and DKA and severe hypoglycemia. And as I said previously, those are the two measures of that, and we had none of those. So that's really great. And to run a study for 6 months and not get any DKA in such a large group, especially when you've got you know, infusion sets that can occlude. But I guess with the CGM going, it was alerting people to get that and sorted it out. How well did the platform perform? So you'll know that I'm sure this group here are aware of how much time you want to spend as much time in automation as possible for it to be effective, right? So that was one of the criticisms of the first Medtronic system that came out. People were only getting about 65-70% time in auto mode. And then with the 780 and with Control IQ, people were getting like 95% time in auto mode. So we found in our study we had 94% time automation. So this just telling you that the platform is extraordinarily stable and keeps you in auto mode. It doesn't sort of kick you out or have all those problems that you can have. That was in the first generation commercial systems anyway. But so that was really nice to see also that it was staying there. Then we have other sort of soft things. We call them device deficiencies or adverse device events. So that's when you where things don't go quite to plan. So you don't get a severe adverse event like severe hyperglycemia or DKA. It's like getting hyperglycemia with ketones or a site infection, those things. And that was balanced between both groups, and there was no algorithm associated adverse device events. So really, and there was minimal. There was like 10 in the adults and 10 in the pediatrics, so 5 in both arms. Five in both arms and 10 in pediatric adults. And it was the usual things, so usually site occlusion. So to me, that's interesting. It still remains now the Achilles heel of automation. You know, back in the day, it was always the sensor, but now it's really the infusion set where the only reason where things come a cropper, if you like. So I guess in conclusion, I've talked relatively quickly, that's one of my own limitations, is that we showed that the open source automation was safe and effective, and it was just really nice to have done. Where to next, I think, is super interesting. You know, does it go for regulatory approval? We didn't set up an entity to do a regulatory approval. As you all know, the tide pool have put a loop in after the study with the JABE. It was just a cohort study, didn't do a comparison arm. And I don't know where that's up to, actually. But what I think is more exciting is that the development pathway through open source is a lot more agile. So the ability to continually improve the code, improve the algorithm, really the next frontier is full automation. I don't know who's listening here, but you know, I follow a lot of people, a few people on the Twitter space and blog spaces about people achieving, you know, 80% time in range with no bolusing. And I'm ready to learn from that and see if we can mimic that in a stomach study. So we're hoping to undertake that study in the future using an open source and see if we can be the first really in a large study, again, to show that you can fully automate without DKA or hypo. I'm sure we'll take a little bit of a time in range hit, but if you can maintain a time in range above 70% with full automation and no bolusing, I'm sure people would be pretty pretty keen for that. So I guess that's it all up. I just a big shout out to the community who are here. I'm sure a lot of the people that are listening are people who have contributed to the code and the community in open source and continue to drive that innovation. Dana Lewis, of course, is on. She's the founder. A lot of people in the world have benefited from that, from your work. I've just come in at the end, really, and shown that all your work has been safe and effective and put to rest those out there who had any doubts. So happy to take some questions, really, I think the idea is the whole panel now being getting Q&A, but I'll just wrap up there.
I just wanted to get clarification that this is, you're using the OREF one that with the full super micro bolus. We've got a number of people that are obviously using open source and have for a while. So this is not just the AMA, but this is the full SMB.
Yeah, absolutely. We had the SMB. It was optional. And then so in open source, you have this onboarding that you go through all these stages, right? So we had to rapid fire that. So we got people automating very quickly. And then adding RF1 OSMB was dependent on the user. So if you're already achieving an awesome time and range and no hypo, there was no point putting it on. But some people really enjoyed that. And also you could do it with carbs on board or not. You know, you could, we allowed all that facilitation and we learned a lot. Like we had to learn all the language of open source about SMBs and when you can put them on and off and all that. I think it's actually a lot more, or I call it precision medicine, really, like compared to the commercial systems where you have a one box trying to fit the general population. I think open source allows the user to dial up certain factors of the algorithm and the way it functions that suits their way of living. And I really like that. I think that automation is awesome. There's no doubt about it. It's a total game changer across all the systems. But then the next step was to have the bit of precision and personalization. I think that's why people really who do use open source really enjoy it. But yes, we had, in short, yes, we could use RF1, but not everybody needed it.
Did you standardize the insulin duration that people had set, or was that settable by the user in the study?
It was settable by the user, but I think we had a guardrail down to 5.5 hours. So that's super interesting. Like that insulin action time, it's really poorly understood by, particularly by healthcare professionals. People with diabetes know it really well, but and it's very different for all the different types of algorithm that are used. You know, in Control IQ, it's set, and in the Medtronic, it's irrelevant. It's just a power gauge. It doesn't even make physiological sense, but you don't really need it. But in open source, that long tail with its short runoff, I think it's a really nice setting as well. But yeah, I don't think it was fixed, but we had it out long, 5.5 hours or something.
Thank you, Dr. Martin de Buck, for coming on today and sharing that amazing research study and all your time and all the amazing stuff you're doing. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Oh, thank you guys, really. I'm just on the piggybacking on all the work you guys have done.
Thank you. I think a few of you guys have mentioned it tonight. I think the best thing about research is connecting with the patient, isn't it? And I guess having this space, having this opportunity to connect with the patients and the people that are going through potentially these elements of studies, I think it must be amazing for you guys to connect and talk, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's extraordinarily rewarding when you can put an intervention in, but it's a double-edged sword because especially in some of the studies, they come to an end. And then if you can't, if there's no alternative for them, you have to take the technology away, and that's really hard as well. So you give all this promise and hope, and that's awesome for them, and then the study ends, and we can't afford to continue to fund their CGM, for example, which is the next step as well. We just CGM needs to be funded for everybody globally, and I'm hopeful for that in the years to come.
And is the full report in due course to be published? Is that right?
It's under review, peer review. So it's under peer review with one of the top journals. So just hold the space. We've had the first review, we've rebutted, and it's going back through the second phase of that. So we hope to announce something there, but I don't want to put the cart in front of the horse, if you like. So you just watch the space. I'll shout it out on Twitter, no doubt, when we hear.
So guys, thank you so much for coming on this evening. We've had 5 amazing research guest speakers come on: Louise, Alpida, Chao Chong Sun, Dr. Shibing Chan, and of course, Dr. Martin de Bock there. Thank you so much. It's been such an incredible evening.